As the years have gone by, I have come to love this beautiful gospel story more and more. And part of one of the reasons that I love it is because it invites us to engage with it on different levels of spiritual discernment and meaning. And I think the first level in which we approach the story is to just concretely think about what's going on at this moment in the gospel. Jesus is being hosted at a dinner given by Mary and Martha, the sisters of Bethany. He has, in the previous chapter of John's gospel, raised their brother Lazarus from the dead. Lazarus is at the dinner also. And during the course of the meal together, Mary kneels down, takes a pound of perfume made from pure nard and pours it out on Jesus' feet and wipes his feet with her hair. Now, just looking at that as it unfolds, you might just think, that is really crazy stuff. That just breaks all of the proper protocol for being at a dinner party. Not only does it violate interactions between men and women in the Judaism of Jesus' day, but there is this pouring out of this expensive perfume on Jesus' feet and the floor, wiping them with her hair. And Judas scowlingly asks the question, why wasn't this perfume sold for 300 denarii and the money given to the poor? And the gospel writer wants us to dismiss that question quickly by telling us that Judas was a thief. He didn't care about the poor. He just wanted to steal more money out of the treasury. But we can't really get away from the question. The 300 denarii, commentators tell us, was equal to a year's wages. That's a lot of expense being poured out here on the floor. It looks like a colossal waste. And we might ask ourselves that same question and say, it's not good stewardship, is it? And we ask the same question that Judas did, and haven't we been taught to care for the poor? Well, every time I hear this story now, I'm invariably reminded of my early days of ministry as the rector of St. Dunstan's Church in Bethesda. I was excited to be there. It was the first time I'd ever been a rector of a parish church. Our family moved down from northern Ohio. We moved into the rectory there on the church grounds. And on a cold December morning, on a Monday, I went down from the rectory to begin my work and got down to the parish office, and the junior warden met me. And he said, John, we've got some good news and we've got some bad news. And I said, what? Well, tell me, what is it? And he said, first the bad news. Somebody hid out in the church a couple of Sundays ago, and after everybody had left after Sunday services, broke into the sacristy and stole all of the communion silver, sterling silver. And we did not have the elaborate security alarm system at St. Dunstan's that we have at St. Albans. I know, I set it off a few weeks ago. But at any rate, he said that's the bad news. The good news is that all of that silver had been previously inventoried and listed and appraised, and the church insurance company assures us that it will give us the full replacement value of the silver. A check is on the way. And I said, well and good, and let's work on getting the sacristy more secure. But the next morning, the wife of the junior warden came down, and she and the junior warden, lovely people. I really came to love them dearly. And she came down to welcome me, and we were talking about our move and our cat. They loved cats and all that sort of conversational chit-chat. And then she suddenly looked at me very seriously, and she said, I have a suggestion. And I said, what is it? And she said, I've been a member of the Altar Guild for a long time at this church, and I think that we ought to take that replacement money and buy communion appointments that are made of earthenware or pewter, and that we don't need the silver. We should take that money and we should give it to agencies in the community serving the poor. Well, I had been in the Society of Friends during my 20s, and there's an old note of Quaker simplicity in me, and I said, Arlene, what a beautiful, generous thought. Let me ponder that, talk it up with some people, and I'll get back to you. The next morning, the senior warden came down to see me. He was on his way to down to his office in downtown D.C., a man of great wisdom, whom I also came to love dearly, and we were talking about church business, and I brought up the junior warden's wife's suggestion. And he stopped and kind of looked down and thought for a few moments. And he looked up at me and he said, John, the ladies of the Altar Guild here are people who are used to fine dining and entertaining guests in their homes. And when they entertain guests, they like to bring out the finest things that they have. China, sterling silver, crystal glassware, and the like. It's their way of honoring the guest who's come to be with them. I think they feel much the same way about the service of God at the altar. If you go through with this thoughtful and lovely suggestion, I can almost guarantee you that a majority of the Altar Guild will be disaffected, and they may defect from the Altar Guild if not stage an outright mutiny. And your days as a rector may be numbered here. And I thought gravely for a moment and looked at him and said, message received. And we went ahead with the replacement of the sterling. I've got more stories about that silver. I can tell you later sometime. But so we went ahead. But I tell that little story because it leads us to the next level of meaning of this gospel story, which is that Mary is honoring Jesus in an expensive, costly way by pouring out this perfume on his feet. And she's not only honoring him, but she is doing a symbolic act that nobody gets. It looks kind of crazy, but what she is doing is following in the line of the old prophets of the Hebrew scriptures, who also did symbolic acts to demonstrate a point that they wanted to make. Isaiah, for instance, walked shirtless and barefoot for 3 years. God told him to do that because he wanted to show people that Assyria was going to conquer Egypt and the Egyptians would be led away in a state of desolation into exile. Jeremiah got a big clay pot and he shattered it in front of a group of religious leaders to tell them that God was bringing judgment upon Judah, and Judah would be shattered. And Ezekiel laid on his right side for 390 days and on his left side for 40 days to demonstrate that God would bring judgment against northern Israel for 390 years and against Judah for 40 years. Mary is following in the footsteps of those prophets by doing what outwardly looks like a crazy thing, but inwardly it is a sign of what's happening. And Jesus gets it. She, leave her alone. She has bought this perfume for the day of my burial. Death is coming. Jesus is going to die. Jesus has just raised Lazarus from the dead. He had previously healed a man born blind. The Pharisees and the religious leaders have said, this guy is getting too popular. There's no wonderment and amazement, and isn't this great? But instead, we've got to get rid of him. We've got to kill him. And when we come to this fifth Sunday in Lent every year, we come to a remembrance of the realization that Jesus must die. Mary gets it. Jesus gets it. The room is filled with the fragrance of the perfume, but commentators like to say it's also the odor of death hanging in the air. And Mary is trying to not only honor Jesus, but say, the death that he dies, what a costly giving of God's love that a man should die. Oh, my friend indeed, wrote Samuel Crossman, who at my need his life did spend. And Mary is symbolizing this in this moment. Love, how deep, how broad, how high. This is the costly nature of God's love. It looks wasteful and ridiculous in the eyes of the world and scandalous, but it is a love that keeps on giving, which is what a parishioner said to me years ago, the night on Maundy Thursday, the night before Good Friday. She said, in John's gospel, in the passion narrative, Jesus just keeps giving and giving and giving and giving, even up to the time in which he takes his last breath. That is the kind of the stupendous nature of God's love, a love supreme. And not only that, but time has grown short. You don't always have me with you, Jesus says. I think about that old MasterCard series of commercials a few years ago. You may remember them where let's say a family is coming from scattered corners to get together for a reunion, and the commercial itemizes all the expenses. Airfare, hotel lodging, big meal, other amenities, and it lists them all out. And then it ends by saying, being together, priceless. This is a costly and yet a priceless moment in which Mary is expending, pouring out this perfume. But that brings us to the third level of meaning, which is that sometimes human beings give of themselves sacrificially. Ours is often not a very loving species. We know that from current events. But human beings sometimes are called to give and to give and to give of themselves to honor someone else and to help them have a good life. And there's no, it's priceless and it's costly at the same time. One of those moments became clear to me recently when Mary and I attended a funeral a few weeks ago for a young man who was 34 years old. He had died of a terrible illness, and we went to the funeral. It was a memorial service. And during that service in the church, the boy's father, the young man's father, got up to speak. And we had known Ed and his wife Anna for a number of years. Ed had business connections with Mary and her work. He got up and he spoke, and he wanted to tell the story of his son, of his life. And he said Brian was the second of two boys born to this couple. He grew up, he was a mischievous little boy, he got into lots of trouble, didn't do well in school, but he loved sports, and he became an athlete, and he played on the state championship varsity football team. He played baseball, soccer, hockey. He loved all manner of sports. He graduated from high school, went off to college, again, did not do well academically, didn't like it, liked to party a lot. We know kids like this. He dropped out of college, but then he found his calling. He went to a culinary institute and got an associate of arts degree, and he became a caterer and a chef, and all seemed to be going very well for Brian in his life until the dad got a call from his wife 7 years ago. Brian was in the emergency room in the hospital, and everything got turned upside down, and he went over there. He didn't tell us why Brian had been admitted, but the doctors there told the couple that Brian had a tumor on the brain, and it was going to have to be removed to save his life, but it would mean he'd be in a wheelchair the rest of his life, and that he would be speech impaired as well. Well, they went ahead with the surgery, and as Brian was recuperating, the doctors came back and told the parents more bad news, which was that he had a rare form of brain cancer, which could be treated for a time, but it would inevitably take Brian's life. There was nothing that could be done. So the reeling from that news, and Ed, the father, looked out at all of us in the church, and he said, you know, I feel like I've made two great decisions in my life. One was to marry my wonderful wife, Anna. The other one was to decide to retire from my work early, and that I would devote all of my energy and life to taking care of my son, to being there for him, to journey with him through all of his chemotherapy and radiation protocols, and to do everything that I could to make his quality of life as rich as it could be. And that's just what he did. And for the next 7 years, they went on trips together to England and to Scotland, on cruises, sporting events. Brian was an inveterate Washington Nationals fan, and they went to ball games. They went to Philadelphia Eagles games in Philadelphia because Ed was a Philadelphia Eagles fan. They did all these things together, journeyed through harrowing chemotherapy protocols, went through experimental trials at NIH. But finally, the time came that Brian was taken, and he died, and we went into hospice care at home, and then passed away. And Ed looked at us and he said, you know, during that 7 years, Brian never complained. He was always had a smile on his face, always spoke optimistically. And I thought for a moment, humbled by the thought that I'd known these parents all those years, and they had never complained either. They were always there. We'd ask how Brian's doing. Oh, he had his ups and downs, but that was their life, taking care of this boy and making sure that he had the best that they could offer him, giving everything. And if there was an aroma in that room that day, it was not the aroma of death. It was the aroma of love. Love that is divine love. Love that bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. A love that never ends. And as I was leaving that service, I thought of the poem that W.H. Vanston, an English priest, wrote a number of years ago called Love's Endeavor, Love's Expense, and it became the title of the book in which the poem appears. It's also in our hymnal, if you want to look it up, hymn 585. Well, let me read some of those verses to you because they're so apropos of this morning's story. Love that gives, gives ever more, gives with zeal, with eager hands, spares not, keeps not, all outpours, ventures all, its all expends. Drained is love in making full, bound in setting others free, poor in making many rich, weak in giving power to be. And Van Stone goes on to write, therefore, he who shows us God, helpless hangs upon a tree. And the cross and the nails and the crown of thorns tell us of what God's love must be. Here is God, no monarchy, throned in easy state to reign. Here is God, whose arms outstretched, aching, spent, the world sustained. Oh, happy race of mortals are we, wrote Boethius 1,500 years ago, when we know that our hearts are ruled, as is this universe, by love, love with a capital L. And my wife can tell you that I just found myself crying at various moments after that service, during the day that followed. And as I walked out, I went to see a slideshow of Brian's life that his mother had prepared, showing him from infancy to before he died, and saw him as a little infant with his proud parents, saw him as a little red-headed boy with a mischievous grin on his face, saw him as a proud football player kneeling down with his football uniform on the state championship team, and saw him in recent years with his Washington Nationals cap on in a wheelchair with a big smile on his face with his parents around him. And I had tears in my eyes because I thought how sad and tragic that a life like this should be taken, but also glory in the power of sacrificial love. You know what sacrificial means. It's from two Latin words, sacer and facere, that means to make sacred, to make holy. When we give of ourselves sacrificially, we're making something holy. And I went up to Ed, the dad, and I embraced him, and I said, what a dad you were and are. And he just looked at me, and he smiled, and he said, that's what dads do. So in the silence that follows, the customary silence that follows, I invite you to think about a number of different things. You can give thanks to God for this love that is so broad and deep and high that Christ has given us by giving of himself and his life. Love poured out for us as that perfume was poured out. Or you might take a moment to think about somebody in your life who helped you sacrificially to be where you are today. Could be a parent, could be a sibling, could be a teacher, could be a mentor, could be a special friend, whoever it might be. Somebody helped you to be who you are, and you can give thanks for that. Or you can think about your own circumstances right now, wherever they may be, with whomever you're living with and having your being with, and you can think about how might God be calling you to give in a deeper, fuller, more wondrous, sacrificial way for the benefit of someone else. Happy mortals are we when we know that our hearts are ruled, as is this universe, by love. In silence and in response to the gospel, let us pray.